Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people will never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
And be part of the conversations that matter on the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. And all of them have Simon Harris on the front page this morning. The Mail's headline, My Daddy, the New Taoiseach. Simon becomes our youngest leader, but rumblings have started over the reshuffle. Pot reshuffle. Lack of reshuffle. No shuffle, really. So he becomes the youngest Taoiseach in the history of the state. He says he's going to bring new ideas, new energy and new empathy into public life. But he pretty much left everything well alone. Couple of changes, obviously. He had to find somebody new to move into his gig and put in a Limerick TD, Patrick O'Donovan, replacing the new Taoiseach as Minister for Higher Education. And then a fellow from Longford, Westmeath, succeeding Simon Coveney as the Minister for Enterprise. Taoiseach, and but nothing else. Helen McEntee is safe in spite of a no-confidence vote 6 months ago after the Dublin riots. Taoiseach and awe, as in shock and awe. Taoiseach and awe is the front pager making the Sun today. Began his role as Taoiseach yesterday by saying that being a father was his number one job. Every single dad would say that. Harris plays it safe on his first day in the job, says the Indo today, with a Conservative cabinet reshuffle. New energy? New hope? Well, it looks to me as if it's the same old gang, and the promotions are very gender unfair, aren't they? Handing both gigs to men. He talked about the Irish story as being a story of hope and optimism. What does that mean? What is the Irish story of hope and optimism? Does it mean that we're never going to quite get there, things are never going to get better, but we have hope and we have optimism? Could somebody explain that? He says, accept the new role in a spirit of humility, ready for the challenge and full of energy. I'm sure he is going into the gig with the best will in the world. Am I coming across as a bit negative about the whole event yesterday? I suppose when you see the likes of the Fianna Fáil leader and the tarnished Micheál Martin, and you see the likes of the Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, two different, supposedly independent, exclusively their own political parties, endorsing the leadership or endorsing the role of Taoiseach for somebody in another party, that always strikes me as quite weird. You would think you would say perhaps nothing at all. Mary Lou, of course, calling for a general election. And the papers also have a photograph from the front of the Irish Times of the new look cabinet. And, you know, no matter what way you look at it, from a Cork point of view and from a human point of view and from somebody who's dedicated a huge chunk of his life to politics, no sign of Simon Coveney in the cabinet lineup. So that would be the first time that a picture like that would have been taken in a long time. Now, whether that's also a blow for us, I don't know on Lee's side. But this morning, that photograph, together with an article from Miriam Lord, makes the front and inside pages. A nearly new cabinet with no blood on the carpet. After talking a tough game, it's kind of as you were. I mean, would that exude much confidence going forward, I suppose? I don't know. He talks about the new energy being promised, but he goes softly with this reshuffle. There is a cracking article in the Indo this morning that talks about the perks of office. Now, it's a €240,000 salary and a private jet. So €240,000 per year, per annum, is six times a standard wage. Now, there are chief executive salaries available in the private sector for a lot higher than that. I get that. But they also say that in spite of the 240,000, it also comes with 24-hour Garda protection, including a limousine and a driver, to which he's already entitled, but he might get a better limousine. I don't know. He's entitled to reside in Steward's House in the grounds of Farmley. It's the state guest house next to the, just adjoining the Phoenix Park, so that's his. He will get personal grooming in terms of a makeup artist available at government buildings to help him with public appearances. Why in the name of God can you not just do it like the rest of us do it and do it yourself? Run a comb or a brush through your hair. Wash your face. Anyway, personal grooming and a makeup artist available. He'll also have a bespoke laundry and ironing service. gimme. Bespoke laundry and ironing. You iron that shirt for me. Iron it yourself. He'll have a diary. He'll have diary secretaries and office managers. He'll have a government credit card to order anything he might want, from fresh flowers to sandwiches for meetings. Simon, will you order the sandwiches for the 2 o'clock meeting? I will, yeah. He'll also have personal communications, fully funded, scrambling whenever he needs them, including the use of a helicopter at his beck and call. Well, the government jet is available for the short haul, and he has an option, should... Who wants to be a millionaire? You have an option, should you choose to take it, of hiring a bigger jet, a jumbo jet, if you have to fly further. So there are the perks of the jobs, lads. The job. Your comments are welcome on that one. Text 0868 104 106. Meanwhile, back down here in the real world, in Terra Firma, this month, in fact, in the next week, it will mark the 100th visit, the two-year anniversary of Martin Leahy travelling from West Cork on the bus to Leinster House on Kildare Street to perform his song, Everyone Should Have a Home. So think about that, you know, compare one with the other. The Echo story this morning is a photograph of Martin Leahy nearly 2 years on. I think the date actually is sometime later this month, April 18th. So that would make it tomorrow week will be the 2 year anniversary. Papers also talk of local politics today. This is quite interesting. If I had been a gambling man, I would have said, no, this vote won't be carried, but it was carried. 12 in favour, 9 against. What, you say? Well, Cork City Council, or at least the councillors, have called for Israel to be bounced out of the Eurovision Song Contest, to be banned. I'll come back to this a little later on this morning. The Solidarity People Before Profit Councillor Brian McCarthy raised the issue, and a majority, 12 to 9, tight enough now, I have to say, tight enough, voted that that should be the case. That it, now, it holds no weight to vote like that, but it's probably just giving, you know, the temperature, or giving the opinions of Cork City Councillors that they don't want Israel in the Eurovision. Seamus was telling me earlier on this morning, and I'd forgot that, Israel, that Russia apparently were thrown out of the Eurovision Song Contest some time ago. But the other possible vote on council last night could have been that Bambi Thug would not perform in Eurovision. So one was to exclude Israel. There was another possibility of a second vote that Bambi Thug would not perform, or would be asked not to participate in the competition. That one didn't go anywhere. But certainly the vote with regards to Israel being bounced certainly did, and it was carried. Now, another thing that was carried happened in the Supreme Court. Do you know how there has been an absolute slashing of compensation payouts in the Irish state following all sorts of changes and new guidelines to reduce damages? A woman challenged that. She fell over a dodgy footpath below in Waterford. She said it was worth $30,000 and she got $3,000 from the Personal Injuries Board. She said it was worth significantly more than $3,000 and she challenged it. She said the guidelines were unfair to persons who suffered personal injury. She tripped and fell on a public footpath in Dungarvan. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court yesterday ruled that the latest personal injuries awards guidelines slashing compensation are legally binding, and on that basis she got no more than the $3,000. What that has done now, according to the Mirror this morning, is it's the last sting of a dying wasp now for the insurance industry for not reducing premiums, because payouts have been absolutely slashed. What excuse have they left now to not dramatically reduce premiums, because the compensations have been dramatically slashed? So hopefully more on that across the morning. Other court cases, well, in America, there's two interesting ones. Oh, in case you didn't know it, the killers, Tom and Molly Martins, are now in a place called Special Pre-Release Phase because of their early impending release. They're going to be out of jail in about 60 days, according to The Independent today. Now, both of them served 4 years and 3 months behind bars for beating Jason Corbett to death with a metal baseball bat and a concrete brick. Of that there is no argument. But 60 days more and they will walk free 4 years after the killing. And then there's a very interesting one also. It makes the UK Times. We're talking about, you know, when teenagers misbehave, who should be found culpable if they're underage? Many have been saying in this programme for years, the parents. Well, check this one out. The parents of a teenager who killed four classmates in a Michigan school. It was a shooting. The parents have been sentenced to at least a decade in prison for failing to stop him. as in failing to stop their son. So it's the first prosecution of this kind. And the husband and wife, Jennifer and James Crumley, are off to jail now because they've been held criminally responsible for the crimes of their 15-year-old son back in 2021. That's interesting, isn't it? Do you think that would catch on here, I wonder? Again, text 0868 104 106. Another few stories making the papers today include crime and criminality in Ireland. It's a photograph of a builder who stalked a woman for more than 6 months. He put a tracker on her car, apparently, and he was watching her every move. It's a front pager making the Star today. And then a homeowner, apparently, so there was this suspected burglar who allegedly broke into his house. So the homeowner had a slash hook, and he slashed him with the slash hook and then took him, the alleged burglar, to hospital afterwards. Now, the intruder could lose the lower part of his right leg after the attack in the house. Now, in America, that would be cool. There'd be no questions asked. But hang on a second. Possibly the same here, because I was reading, that under current legislation, it's not a criminal offence for a homeowner to attack a trespasser in self-defence. But it would have to be self-defence. I mean, if you came up behind the burglar and the burglar's downstairs and you took him from behind or something, and essentially gave him a hit with a baseball bat over the back of the head, that, I suppose, would not be self-defense. And then with regards to self-defense, trying to live longer and live healthier, anybody ever have kippers for breakfast as opposed to, say, for instance, the full Irish? Like, a great old combo of a morning would be kippers and pan-fried tomatoes, or kippers and baked beans, or maybe kippers and scrambled eggs. I mention them because I particularly love kippers, and I love sardines and all sorts of things like that. They're strong on omegas, and they're very good for you, and they reduce heart disease and everything, and knock bowel cancer down a few percent and stuff like that. But there's a story in the paper saying today, get rid now of the bacon and sausages in the fry-up. It'll keep you out of an early grave if you turn to herrings and sardines and kippers instead, just mentioning it. But meanwhile, a buddy of mine, Liam, sent me some very interesting stats yesterday, and I'll come back to it a little later on. The amount of fruit and vegetables that we are importing into Ireland is absolutely bizarre. 83% of all of the fruit and vegetables that we eat in Ireland, we import from overseas. I'll break it down for you later on. I'll set some time aside for you. But potatoes, apples, now we do grow like 300 tons of potatoes in Ireland, TG, but we still import 75,000 tons into the country. But that's the only exception. Apart from that, we're bringing in all of the apples, the tomatoes, the cabbages, the onions, the carrots, the mushrooms, the cucumbers, the lettuce, the garlic, the blueberries, the oranges, the mandarins, all of them. Now, some of them probably would never take here on an industrial scale like oranges and mandarins, but you would think that we could certainly grow the rest of them. But we're not anymore, which is sad. Papers also talk of, there is a website out there that we were chatting about them some weeks ago. We never did anything about it. We might have another look at it. It's called, it's a website, a group for women. It's called, Are We Dating the Same Guy? Are We Dating the Same Guy? Sounds interesting, doesn't it? But there's a bachelor now, a bachelor, the English Mail is saying, attempting to sue 50 women after they started a Facebook group to warn other women about him being a bad date. What does it mean, bad date? Like boring, dull, bad personal hygiene, I was going to suggest was it something over the bill, but probably just boring, I suppose. So he's suing now because these posts that they put up about him, this chap by the name of Lucas Murray, he says that the posts that women have put up about him left him suffering from emotional distress, PTSD, and mortification. Mortification. I'm mortified. So this is a story making the Mail today. And then there's an infidelity coach is teaching men how to get away with being unfaithful. This is a man story. This is involving men who cheat on their partners. But they actually break down all of the different signs that you'll know, primarily if your husband or boyfriend is cheating on you. One, you'll see small signs of changes in his digital behavior. The other one is he's deactivated his Google Maps history. Here's an interesting one. The car is spotless and reeks of air freshener. I don't know why. I'll come back to it later on. You find new clothes in a separate rucksack. It's actually quite sad when I read these, isn't it? He's seeing his friends more often. He's never available at lunchtime. He started doing more housework. Apparently, men start doing more housework because they're feeling guilty, apparently. It was quite interesting, but very sad at the same time. So we'll come back to that also a little later on this morning. Text 0868104106. Pick up the phone on 0818104106. I'm not going to take a break now because I'm going to go straight to Pauline Dooley, who's currently sitting in the ED, the emergency department, the A&E at Cork University Hospital, and has been there since 4 p.m. yesterday afternoon, I believe. To the phone lines we go. Pauline, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for giving my full name now, and I'll probably be hauled away from here in handcuffs.
You won't. My apologies. I wasn't aware that I wasn't supposed to give out your full name. It's all right, because all you're doing is telling the truth and seeing what you saw. What are you going through? Tell me what it's been like since 4 o'clock yesterday.
Listen, it's been very busy, and you can understand. It's a very, very busy hospital. It's the main hospital in Cork. It's very busy. I believe the Mercy was closed last night because all the ambulances were directed over here, and that's totally understandable.
Do we know why the Mercy was closed last night?
No, I don't. But just one of the nurses kind of said it in passing. Maybe she shouldn't have said it. Maybe it's for the fog light. I don't know. But what the point I'm getting to is, while we have no choice to put up with the health system, because the health system has been broken for many a year, and we all know that, but the point I'm getting to, there's absolutely no privacy. There was an article the other day there on the Sunday Independent of the retired consultant, and he said he spent 4 days on a trolley. I don't remember if he named the emergency department he was in, and all he had was a curtain for dignity. There's no curtain in CUH. We're sitting in glass pods, as they call it, and we're lined up, and those glass pods are just perspex between you and the person, so you can actually chat away to the person and talk quite easily.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fine. I can understand why that is with the COVID. In fairness, they put that in. But at 6:30 this morning, 6:08, a female doctor came down who you would imagine, you know, would have a bit of empathy towards a young 22-year-old girl who was very obviously in pain all night, had been up and down, very uncomfortable, and started talking in front of myself, the two women who were sat next to me, the man in his 40s with a small wife, but the man in his 70s on the other side of her, all about, and she's questioning, your bowel movement, her last menstruation cycle, was she passing urine? Did she not consider that if she hadn't gone to the toilet for 2 or 3 days, she was constipated?
Did you hear all of this? Obviously you did, yeah?
I heard all of this, and I stopped her, and I said, excuse me, doctor, I said, is there no consultation room? I said that you... Now, I heard her, the people from next to me heard her, but the other 20 in the surrounding room, in the hallway, because it's out in the atrium here, the old atrium of CUH, where the coffee bar used to be long ago. And I said, have you no consultation room? And she said to me, and she started berating me. And she said, there is no consultation room, there is one, but unfortunately it's been used, and it would be 2 hours. And she put it on the bed, said, do you want to wait 2 hours? Do you want to wait 2 hours? And then she said to me, what business is of yours?
What business is it of yours? What did you say? What did you say to that?
I said to her, surely GDPR, he said, I shouldn't be listening to all this. I said, surely be to God, they said, you can say, you could even stoop down to her level and talk to her in a normal voice, a quiet voice. And she said, well, usually I carry around a chair, but as you can see, it's quite tight here for space. You're cramped. And I haven't got room to fit in a chair.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm sorry, now I'm going to stop you there. I said, because I feel you're quite aggressive. I said, and while there's signs up saying that bullying and abuse towards our staff won't be tolerated, I said, I actually don't see one where it says any abuse towards the patients won't be tolerated either from the doctors. And I said, you know, you can't go on like this. And she said to the girl again, I need to talk to you, or we can wait 2 hours until a consultation room. So are you, you telling me, in the whole of CUH here, ED, there's one consultation room. Yeah. Now, Neil, there was actually a second toilet, 2 toilets in the vicinity, that she could have said, come on in here and we'll have a chat. I apologise.
Now, I understand that it's embarrassing for the girl or for anybody. I mean, I was in there the back end of last year and it was rammed with people. I felt sorry for all of us that were stuck in there, but I felt very sorry for the staff, I have to say. But I could hear the doctors.
I could hear everything.
Do you appreciate what I'm saying, Pauline? I could hear the doctors going from person to person to person, really. It was like triage, you know what I mean? It was like almost as if we were in some kind of an emergency. Okay, you're under pressure? Yeah, okay, I think there's a doctor coming. And that's the reason I wanted to talk to her before the outbreak. But I understand, maybe I might get an opportunity to talk to her again a little later on. I understand what she's saying. Because I was in a similar situation last year when I was in the A&E. And I remember talking about it on the air at the time. And Pauline is right in that regard. I could hear all of the conversations around me as well with other people talking about what was wrong with them, being asked medical questions. There was a very elderly husband and wife not too far from me. But I remember thinking at the time how kind and compassionate and patient the doctor actually was while chatting to the elderly couple. And I was remarking on that on the air. But I understand, that it's far from ideal in there. It's very far from ideal. Did you want to jump in on that, Claire? I see you got cans on. No, you're working on something else. The rest of the conversation is, she says, I politely asked her to lower her tone. And I said there was no need to be aggressive and maybe she could stoop down lower towards the young lady. And she simply made a skit of me saying, I usually bring a chair, but there's no room here. Like, what kind of provisional services is that doctor on? Surely in this day and age, the COH has more than one examination room. They used to say long ago, if you were going in to have a baby, leave your dignity at the gate and collect it on the way out. Pauline says, I find absolutely no dignity in the COH A&E at the moment, and definitely no cop on. Surely, at least, if nothing else, it's a serious breach of GDPR to be able to hear other people's medical condition and of interest to you if you're haven't seen a doctor despite being sent down from the Midlands with severe numbness in my whole body since last Thursday. So that's the reason she's there. The nurses are lovely and hardworking, but the system that allows this to happen is absolutely broken. That was from around about 6:30 this morning when she posted that, having been in the A&E. And I suppose she's tired as well. You're sitting in that armchair long time. And she's there since 4 p.m. yesterday afternoon with 137 people waiting on four nurses and two doctors. Imagine doing that job, 137 people being looked after by four nurses and two doctors. It's chaotic, to say the least. Trolley Watch at the COH says there are 73 people on trolleys, which don't include the 137 people in the various armchairs and on chairs around the A&E. There's 73 on trolleys, and there's another 57 in corridors and another 16 in wards on a trolley. So when you break down the 73, it's 57 in corridors, 16 in wards, and 137 sitting in armchairs and all sorts of makeshift scenarios within the A&D itself, many of them in those pods. Your thoughts, text 0868 104 106.
Call Neil now, 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Text 0868 104 106. You make me sick, Neil, telling us you feel sorry for the staff. They're paid to do a job. There's very sick people in there and they're more important. They're having the crack. I didn't say anybody. No one's having the crack in there. If the staff can't do their job, let's get people in there who can. Well, I don't know, you're entitled to your opinion and your own thoughts, but I don't necessarily agree with it. Not 100% anyway. I think the people in there are working as hard as they can, and I do feel sorry for them. If you've been through it, you see them doing the best they can in awful conditions. Anyway, I'll come back to that later, so do text 0868 104 106. But I've already told you what the papers are making of Simon Harris, his new job as Taoiseach of the country. Let's see what John Jumbo Kearns of the Irish Mirror thinks about it, having digested much of it since yesterday afternoon. John, good morning.
Morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. So here we have his first day in the job. He's left no blood on the carpet. He spoke about lots of new energy, but yet there's nothing changed apart from he moves a new person in to get his gig and another new person in to get Simon Coveney's old gig. That's all.
That was one big boring damp squib, you know. Same old faces, same old regime, very little change. Simon Harris played it safe. And a typical Simon Harris, it was all leaked well in advance beforehand. So there was absolutely no surprises, you know. I mean, this guy was talking about coming in, bringing energy to the government, bringing energy to his party. I thought we'd see some sort of a bloodbath and that he would have got rid of it. I know, I think he's got about six full-time, six, seven ministers in cabinet. I thought he would have got rid of a few of them, to be honest. And I was astonished that Helen McEntee survived now.
Okay, why did she survive? I mean, there was obviously a vote of no confidence 6 months ago after
the drop. He bottled it. He just wanted to play it safe. He absolutely bottled it. You know, like Helen McEntee, you know, when she first came into that portfolio, I had great hopes for her. And I actually thought at some stage, you know, she could be a future leader of Fine Gael and a possible future Taoiseach. But she's just had a terrible last 8 or 9 months. You know, first of all, you know, when she walked the streets of Dublin afterwards, an American tourist was attacked and brutally beaten up in the centre of the city. And she said that, you know, she walked the streets of Dublin accompanied by a number of Gardaí, and she was saying that the streets of Dublin were safe, when the dogs in the streets of Dublin knew that the city was far from safe, that there was a huge issue with antisocial behaviour, as there is in many towns across the country. And there's a shortage of guards everywhere. You know, and they haven't got the numbers in there in the Gardaí. You know, they're only bringing in, they promised 1,000 extra cops. They've been bringing in 600 or 700, I think, in the past 12 months, right? But it's all been too slow. And also, there's been things going on in the guards, and she hasn't spoken out to defend the guards. And every row that's gone on between the rank and file and the Garda commissioner, she's taken the side of the Garda commissioner.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, and she's not had her own opinion. You know, and Harris has made this thing law and order, you know, back to Fine Gael basics. You know, we're going to make everyone safe in a home. We're going to make streets safe. And yet he leaves the woman there, who's been obviously very bad at her job in the last 8 months or so. And, you know, we had the scenes of the Dublin riots, which were disgraced. Those pictures went round the world. You know, we had a no confidence motion, which Helen McEntee survived. And he just leaves her in the job.
But will he make one blind bit of a difference then as the new Taoiseach? I mean, will he have different stances on housing or health or the immigration crisis, or it'll be just more of the same?
Come here. It'll be just more of the same. They can spin it all they want. I mean, they were putting out this line, he didn't want to rock the boat. He wanted experienced people in there, that he brought in new faces into the cabinet, that the permanent government, the civil service, would run rings around them and they wouldn't have enough time to implement major policies. But let's remember this. The programme for government is there. It's agreed between the three parties. You know, and that's what they're going to stick to until we eventually have a general election, you know, which I think will be sooner rather than later, to be honest. I think it'll all unravel in the coming months when we get into the summer. We're going to have the local elections, European elections in June, and the people will have their say, and that will be the start. And I think Fine Gael and I think a lot of the government party is going to have a bad day at the office. And I think things will start to go downhill after that. I can see a lot of Fianna Fáil backbenchers getting very panicky. And I don't think they're going to just sit there and let Fine Gael, you know, dictate the agenda. And I can see issues among the backbenches between, you know, at least two or three of the parties in government over the coming months.
They're saying in the general election Michal might say,
you know.
Yeah, well, they are saying that independence will rule the roost come the next general election.
Absolutely.
That a load will get elected. Do you know Simon Harris? What kind of an individual is he?
I don't know Simon Harris. I never met him. He's probably one of the few that I don't know. I've never met him. You know, he was always a great self-publicist. And I'm listening to all these guys and all these commentators and all the, you know, and various politicians out saying, well, the great thing about Simon is he's a great communicator. I thought, if you want to be a Taoiseach, you know, the great thing should be that you get things done. And he hasn't been very good at getting things done. I was just listening to those shocking figures about people in the hospitals in Cork, you know, 157 people on armchairs. Absolutely shocking.
Yeah.
No wonder the electorate are furious. And then when you look at the housing situation, and he was Minister for Health, and he was a very, very bad Minister for Health. He just didn't succeed, you know, and he failed dismally at the job. But they're all saying, oh, he'll make a great Taoiseach because he's a great communicator. I thought the job of Taoiseach and the government is to get things done.
True
for
enough.
People.
Yeah. How did he manage to pull this off? It was no battle.
Climate. I'll tell you why. If you look at it, right, well, you know, I think Fine Gael are going to be in for a very bad 12 months between the local Europeans, and I think they're going to lose seats all over the place, including the next general election. The chances of him being, the chances of the leader of Fine Gael becoming our next Taoiseach after this, I think, are very few and far between. Because the party has been in power for 13 years and people are sick of listening to them and looking at them and all the rest of it, voter fatigue has set in and they need a spell on the opposition benches. If you look at people like Simon Coveney, high quality people, you look at Pascal Donoghue, they weren't going to go for the leadership because they were only going to get 10, 11 months as Taoiseach, if even that. They might, Harris might only get 6 months. Mm. Right, or 7 months, and so they were then going to be looking at 5 years in opposition on the chipkin and chip circuit, as Charlie Hoy used to say, and they would have been running around the country trying to rebuild the party. So I think the likes of the Fine Gael heavy hitters, and that's who I would regard Simon Coveney and how I would regard Pascal Donoghue. Right, I mean, to me, Pascal Donoghue would make a great prime minister. I think he was being an excellent finance minister over the past several years, and and when he was minister for finance and then minister for public expenditure, he's got a very, very good track record. I thought Coveney is a political heavyweight. I know he's won your own down there, but I thought the job he did in foreign affairs, and there's no votes in Brexit, by the way, but I thought he was outstanding. Right, but there was no votes in it. And Simon Harris has just come into it because there was nobody really else.
Okay, so there was nobody else interested in it. But what do you think happened to Simon Coveney? Did he go? Was he pushed?
I think Simon Coveney probably knew. Well, I'd say he probably knew the writing was on the wall and there was a chance he was going to be pushed. And a bit like Leo Varadkar, he decided to get out on his terms. Remember, he's had a hell of a run of it. You know, and he's been in government. He's been a minister for several, he must be minister now for about 10 years.
Yeah, but he's only 51,
I know that. Okay. But these are changed times. You've got a lot of people going into politics at a younger age and moving out, because they'll only do so much. And there was talk of him stepping down there, over the past several months. I think, to be honest, I think when they moved him out, I think Simon Coveney loved being in foreign affairs. And I think when they moved him out of that, he didn't have the same impact or the same profile.
And do you believe that he'll go into the private sector now and that he will not run in the next election?
I don't know where Simon Coveney will end up, he may well go into the private sector. Personally, I think Simon Coveney would make great president someday.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you think Micheál would make a great president?
Absolutely. You've got two of them down there.
I
think they're two good, decent fellas who, have done the best of the country. There's still massive issues, but there's always going to be issues. There's always something else coming along. When I was growing up and you were growing up, it was all about emigration and
jobs.
Employment. Now it's all about housing and health. Different issues, different times. And there'll be other issues coming down the track. They'll get a grip on the housing over the next 5 or 6 years. It doesn't matter who's in government. They will eventually get a grip on it. And then there'll be something else coming along.
I'm wondering also, though, as to whether or not the government will run its term or will they call it early? I mean, he said no, it's going to run its term. If you were a gambling man, would you see it sooner or later?
Oh, I'd see it sooner. I think after, let's see how the European and local elections go and then see the fallout after that. And, I can see a lot of rivalry between the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil backbenches and various TDs and the government side squabbling in various constituencies and worried about their seats. And, I think they'll find it very, very difficult. They'll do their best. The ministers will do their best to go full term, but I think it'll be very difficult to keep it all together. I really do. And you never know what's around the corner as well. Personally, I think they'll have a budget, in October, and it'll be a big giveaway budget. And, do they want to be going around knocking doors in January and February? I know Micheál says they will and they want to go full term and blah, 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 but I don't really believe, I don't think it's doable. I think they'll end up, we'll have general election at the end of October.
So let's say it's October then. That gives Harris no time to do anything, even if he's talking about new energy. But at the same time, which of them, if any, Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, which of them would talk to Sinn Féin in the event of needing a coalition and needing numbers?
I think it's going to be very difficult for Sinn Féin to get an overall majority. So we're going to have a coalition. I think we're going to be having coalitions for years to come. And even if Sinn Féin have a fantastic election, they could win 70 seats. They're going to be short. You know, so are they going to bring in, you know, they're trying to negotiate with people for poor profit. They could be looking to the Social Democrats, depending on how many seats they have, or to Labour, again, depending on when many seats they get. And that's very difficult to predict. I think if Labour got 6 or 7 seats, to be thrilled. The Social Democrats will be looking to go 10 plus or whatever. But the next government, to me, is probably going to be Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil.
So you think if there's a deal to be done, it would be done with Fianna Fáil?
I think it'd be deal, because they want a stable government. I think if there's a deal to be done, it would be done with Fianna Fáil, yeah. That's what I think.
Of course, Sinn Féin would say that they will get an overall majority. Donal O'Leary said to me on the air yesterday, we've had 3 Taoiseachs now in 4 years. He says it's just chaos. We need an election, full stop.
Yeah. Well, like, I agree. I mean, I don't think Simon Harris has got a mandate from the people in any shape or form. You know, at least Leo, Micheál Martin, Mary Lou went to the country as the leaders of the 3 main parties, and when you fought with you, you knew who you were voting for as a possible Taoiseach. You know, Simon Harris wasn't in the frame in any shape or form. You know, he was just a minister. So I don't think he's got a moral mandate from the people. He may constitutionally have a mandate because he was elected by the Dáil, but to me, he doesn't have a moral mandate from the people. So I think we need an election, and I think we need to sort it all out. We've had 4 years. I know under the Constitution the government can go up to 5 years, but that very rarely happens. Now, this government have stuck together through thick and thin, in fairness to them, and they're sticking to their programme for the government. The Greens will absolutely not want an election in any shape or form, because they'll be fearing that they're going to lose a lot of seats and that they could be on the opposition benches for another decade. So it's all there to play for. But it's going to be very difficult for the Sinn Féin to get an overall majority, because we got an extra 14, I think it is, Dáil seats. So to have them, I think you know, to have a majority, I think they need something in the about 88 seats or something like that. So and to get that would be very, very difficult. So I think we're looking, you know, if you look at the polls at the moment, if you look at the numbers, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens together would be not too far away. But you know, as it stands, Sinn Féin have been dropping a few percentage points in recent opinion polls.
Yeah, I know, but those opinion polls proved to be very, very wrong and inaccurate, certainly with regards to the last 2 referendums, you know? So you don't know.
Well, I don't believe the opinion polls at all, to be quite honest about, and especially a lot of these telephone polls. And I would concur with you on that. And they've been way off the mark in the referendum. I mean, I knew, like, a month before this referendum, people started talking about it, there was not a chance of hell, because everyone I spoke to was voting no.
And yet we were told it would be tight enough, but it won't would be carried.
Absolutely, yeah. But I wouldn't believe in opinion polls. I think that the voters, whether the government like it or not, are irritated about a lot of different things. And we may have a booming economy, we may have low unemployment, but in terms of the pocket, the people don't feel as if their families are booming.
No, they just want them to fix health, homes, and crime. Yes. That's what they want fixing. And if they could do that.
That's what, and they don't want to see their kids emigrating. Like, you know, my 2 kids have emigrated. You know, and they both said they don't see any future for themselves in Ireland. That it's too expensive to buy a house, and the bills have gone up. I was listening to Tommy Moore-Bourne, their minister, last night, Fianna Fáil minister, saying on the television, oh, well, the kids aren't going away. That's nonsense. Ireland's a great country. It may be a great, but any young person I speak to, you know, really struggles this idea that they're going to have to save up 50 or 60 grand or whatever it is to get a home. You know, and that they just, you know, they just don't like the way certain things are run. And they look at the house service and see it's a disaster. It is a disaster. You know,
okay.
And it's really frustrating everybody. And it doesn't matter how much money we put into the Department of Health, you know, the money just seems to go AWOL. And nothing seems to improve. That's the other thing people want. You know, they want accountability. They're sick of seeing, like, the new National Children's Hospital and all these government projects where our taxpayers' money is just thrown away. And, you know, they don't seem to have any control whatsoever. Every family in Ireland has to keep their house and run it on the income that they have. But yet the government can seem to just waste money left, right and centre. And that really irritates the people.
I think a lot of people would concur with everything you've said this morning with regards to trying to survive in Ireland in 2024. John, thanks for taking the call. As always, watch this space. John Kearns from the Irish Mirror. Text 0868 104 106. Back after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
If you don't provide an ideal environment for people working in healthcare, you're going to have situations like we talked about this morning where somebody's personal details are being heard by everybody else. The environment there lends itself to everybody being able to hear everybody's business because we're in chaos. Here's another example of it. I can't take a call on air because I haven't told my family yet, but I was told I needed to be tested for multiple sclerosis in front of a room full of other people. That's worth repeating. I was told I needed to be tested for multiple sclerosis in a room full of other people. That's sad. It shouldn't be that way. It's not acceptable, but that's where we are. And that's where we've been for quite some time. And it doesn't get better. It just gets worse. Some things do work from time to time. Got a text overnight there from a pal of mine who said, my passport expires in September. I decided to renew it now within the 6 month period, which you can do. I went online Monday. Just gone at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, applied for a new passport, uploaded a digital picture, and I have the new one in the post this morning. So from Monday to Wednesday, a day and a half, and it travelled with the post overnight. Wouldn't you just wish that all of our government services acted this fast? You certainly would. It can be done. And I suppose in a digital world, it goes to show how quickly, on the one hand, how quickly things can happen when it's all digitalized and automated. But again, the more you digitalize, the less people you have physically doing. I don't want to sound like a Luddite here now, but the less people involved in the procedure, of course, unfortunately, in this case, the more efficient it is. If the government wants to take up the numbers and wages for Gardaí, they'd have to go to Germany and ask and say, please. This all goes back to the European Union. It would be the same for rates of pay for your teachers or your nurses. It would all have to be cleared. People saying that the guards are badly paid. Over 50 grand a year is a good wage, no matter what anyone says. What do people actually want? Everyone wants everything straight away now. I'm just weary about the constant greed and entitlement attitude of a lot of people. Okay, well, if you just park all of the constant greed and the entitlement of other people, put those aside, what about everybody else that isn't greedy or isn't entitled because they're out working hard for a living? Do you have any empathy at all for them? And the figure of 50 grand a year depends how long you are a guard, incidentally. Leo left Ireland with a surplus, all right, a surplus of crime. Nothing will change. Most of Carrigaline was targeted by thieves the other night, checking and breaking into cars. It's a free-for-all as the guards are nowhere to be seen, especially as the station is closed 21 hours a day. Now, that texter also sent some videos to me of examples of these break-ins. Didn't want to come on air, but I saw the videos myself. And then, of course, much of what's happening, of course, means that people, as Jumbo Kearns was saying, are leaving the country and heading to Australia. Isn't it ironic that historically it was the criminals that were sent to Australia? Now we've come full circle. Now it's the law upholders, not the law breakers, that are leaving for Oz. And a final one for now, Varadkar. Harris and his elite circle will never struggle or sit in an A&E for 12 plus hours. They will never be on a trolley for days on end. They also won't be living in their home box room for a life, thanks to the housing mess they've made. The basics are hitting the ordinary person worse than ever, thanks to this lot in government. And that's four lines of the truth there from Anthony by text to 0868 104 106. We'll pick it up after 10.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation, the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. Now, it looks as if Colin Burke is going to get a gig, a junior ministry gig. He would go into health, I think, isn't it? Junior Minister for Health. We'll have to see what actually happens, but at least it's something for Cork. And John says, I believe that Colin Burke recently on your programme is right about the jobs. The rest in Ireland, the rest of Europe are jealous of Ireland's initiative in securing international jobs. Can I also say that the housing crisis is Europe-wide and the health service is not much better around Europe? I beg to differ on that, John. I speak to many, many people who go through the health system in Spain. And no matter what you say about the UK, which has now gone from the EU, but even when it was in the EU, their health service is free at point of entry. Anyway, he says, I've always voted for people who have helped me and the people of the North Side, the likes of Dave McCarthy, Danny Wallace, Bernard Allen, Kathleen Lynch and Gerry O'Sullivan. Colin Burke will be getting my vote this time. He was the only one that assisted me and gave me great advice with an issue in recent times. Others refused. They said things like there would be a conflict of interest when really it wasn't. It was just an excuse for them not to help me, says John by email. In other news then, besides targeting productive individuals who would be of net benefit to the Australian society, what's the difference between what Australia is doing, guerrilla marketing or Gardaí, and what Roderick O'Gorman did with his form of guerrilla marketing when he sent out a tweet to allow, amongst others, the dregs of the world. He sent it in multiple languages, telling them all to flock to Ireland, where their every need would be catered to. That's more guerrilla marketing for you, says Richie in Toker. And then one or two more from this morning, because I just want to see what you guys are responding to, whether I covered already. Simon Harris will be the shortest serving Taoiseach ever. John Bruton holds that record at 924 days. The election will be within 300 days, and that texter suggesting we'll see no more of the Taoiseach Simon Harris at that stage. Simon Harris, hardly a new brush, more like a light dusting with his so-called cabinet reshuffle. Meet the new boss, it's the same as the old boss, says Paddy. All the pomp and ceremony for an unmandated leader who could be gone in less than a year, and no big change in any of the main jobs at the top, says Anthony, as in nothing to see here. Simon Harris has to be seen making changes each day of his leadership. Helen McEntee was a good decision. She's working on at least 30 different bills, and she should not be disrupted. So there's a Helen McEntee supporter. John Kearns on about Helen McEntee saying that the streets of Dublin are safe. What was she supposed to say? Please, Americans, don't come to Ireland because there's a chance that you'll be assaulted. Come on. Thank you for the text. Martin says, how come the promotion and recruitment freeze that's in place in the HSE at the moment doesn't apply to government promotions like yesterday with Harris and his crew, says Martin. And one more for now, Fionnán Sheehan also said that Simon Harris bottled it when it came to the Helen McEntee job, and that her walking through Dublin with 10 guards didn't help her. The hate speech law is all she wants, so no one can say anything in the future. We'll all be muzzled and shut up, says Tony. Why don't you just join Sinn Féin? Or maybe you already have, says Jim. Your hard cases. I mean, I've said it a million times before. I have no idea whether there's a certain element of people listening to me believe that I'm a Sinn Féin supporter. Would it be fair to say, really, that in an ideal world, oh, you can't do this, you should vote the best person for the job on an individual basis? But if you do that, I suppose, in Irish politics, it just leads to absolute chaos, doesn't it? Because no party gets elected then, or no real true reflection of the public vote. I'm an elderly lady. I have very little mobility. My children usually do my shopping for me, and I haven't gone shopping since before Christmas. On the way back from the doctor's recently, I decided to pop into Lidl myself. The rain was lashing down, and I parked in a mother and baby spot. This is an elderly lady with very little mobility. I parked in a mother and baby spot. I have a blue badge, but these spots were closer to the shop, so I went with one of those. You can park anywhere with the blue badge, you know. I got out of the car, got out my walker, and a lady passing by in a people carrier shouted out her window at me saying, "You're a disgrace! You're a disgrace!" I couldn't believe it. I wish people would be more compassionate and put themselves in other people's shoes. I cannot for the life of me understand why anybody, be it male or female, but in this case you say it was a woman, why anybody would shout something like that to an elderly person who has a blue badge, incidentally, with a mobility scooter. I mean, why would you be so unkind? It's easy to say that the youth can go and live and leave and work in any other country. But what about the youth who want to leave but have lifelong conditions that they're only covered for here, health-wise? You cannot get covered in other EU countries at all, let alone if you move to Australia or Canada. If we can cover Ukrainians for conditions in Ireland, other EU countries should also cover people with conditions too who are well capable of working and living in other countries. Thank you for that. I mean, I know that it's more of an exclusive issue in a sense, but it does impact on some people. And then I know you get messages week in, week out about the goings-on outside the GPO of a Wednesday morning. Well, I can tell you for a fact that the GPO is being patrolled today. And I suppose now the GPO has become a pinch point, and the Gardaí are probably more aware of potential issues outside the GPO on Oliver Plunkett Street because of the attack on the Dublin girl a couple of weeks back. And unfortunately, all too often, particularly when it's kind of social welfare day, you do get a fairly, let me just say, interesting group gathering. We got calls on the way. I'll take a call now if you don't mind, because Niamh's under a little bit of pressure. So Maeve, I should say. Maeve, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. We started this morning with a hands-on live update from the A&E at CUH. What have you got for me?
Well, first of all, I suppose I just like to pay my own respects to you, Neil, on the passing of your father last year, because I was listening to you when you came back after he had passed away.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Thank you so much. No, because my own dad passed away, you see, Christmas Day 2022 in the CUH, Neil, and I was probably in the midst of my own grief accepting it when I felt very sorry for you when you came on air.
It's the passage of life. We all have our time. You're very kind to say that. I have to say that in my own experience in the CUH, when my father was dying and did pass away, the staff were absolutely, absolutely terrific. I know it's a much quieter area of the hospital, end of life, but they were just so kind and compassionate, and I hope you found the same.
I didn't, Neil, and I thought that's a sad thing. I'm glad you did, and I was so happy at the time because I like to hear those nice stories, because not everyone has a bad experience, Neil. I suppose for us, back in 2020, my father was in hospital for 3 months in the CUH, and we did have that amazing experience. Everything was fantastic. The system worked brilliant for us. My father was given 3 months to live back in 2020, and we brought him home, and amazingly for us, with the care we gave at home, he actually lasted for 2 years.
What was his condition, do you mind me asking? I'm just curious.
He had he was diagnosed in 2020 with cryptogenic cirrhosis of the liver, kind of, I suppose, fatty liver due to diet and lifestyle. He was 85 then. And we were advised at that time, Neil, to put him into a nursing home, but we said no, because it was during COVID. We hadn't seen him in 8 weeks in the hospital, and we were going to bring him home.
Okay.
So we took him home. We had a lot of work to do with my dad. We'd given 24-hour care for many months. We had to fight for help from everyone. You know, every door closes in your face, but we were persistent. We got the help that we needed, and fantastic for us, he did brilliant. But September 2022, my dad found he was becoming very ill again. It was advised that we bring him back to the hospital maybe for 2 or 3 days. Sadly for us, we never got him out of the hospital. But I suppose just some things we witnessed when my dad was in at that time, Neil, especially with the elderly, really upsets me still to this day, because I just find what's going on in the hospital, and because I witnessed it in there, it was very upsetting.
Okay, we're talking about geriatric ward of the CUH, is it?
I am. I'm talking about the geriatric
ward.
The geriatric. Okay. Because when I found him, my father was in the hepatology ward. When he was in the cardiac unit, the care was amazing. But when he came down to the geriatric ward, it was very different. It's just very different, because a lot of these older people are palliative. My father was palliative at that time in September. And I just found that the whole manner, how they treat them, how they speak to them, how they care for them, I just didn't like it. We never left my father alone, because we never liked the way he was being kind of treated when we weren't there. Things like, if we were gone, the bed managers would come. They'd tell my father, you know, you're going home today, you're going home tomorrow, or you're going into this home, or you're going into that home. And he used to really upset him. And we would say, you know, don't speak to my father, come to us. So we found that kind of behaviour wasn't nice. Mm. Every day they would come in and pull the curtains around, individual beds. They might say to such a man, you're going to this home today. And he'd say, but I don't want to go to that home. I want to go back to my own home. An hour later, I come in, there'll be a black bag by the bed. That man will be leaving. We didn't know where he was going. Mm. One man actually asked me one day, he said, can you tell me where this home is? I'll actually get upset now, because
tell me where I'm going, is it? Yeah.
Can you tell me where this place is, he said, because I don't want to go there, I want to go home. So that kind of thing was going on hugely. And another huge thing, Neil, that really upsets me to this day is the medications that they give. Now, you speak a lot about drugs in Cork City, which is awful. People getting drugs down the side lanes. What about our elderly, Neil, in the hospitals? What about the medications that are given to them? What about the sleeping tablets that are given? My father was given antipsychotic medication as an anti-nausea medication. An antipsychotic medication that absolutely drove him insane, but it was given to stop him from vomiting.
Right. And when you say drove him insane, what was he having, nightmares, or was he having
hallucinations?
Yeah,
hallucinations, to the point where we had to get somebody to, a care person, to sit at the bed with him because he didn't know what was going on. And we asked to take him off the tablet. And when I went up one day, the tablet was removed, but it was given in another form. You know, you have your generic tablet. So there was, it was the same drug with a different name, because I was very insistent on looking at the charts always, and they never wanted to show us the charts.
Would you have understood what you were looking at, though?
Yeah, I would have a background in nursing myself.
Okay.
So I would have understood. But I suppose just things like that, I would say to families, when you're, especially the elderly, if they're in hospital, don't always be so trusting. Ask what medications they're given. Ask why. And just because a nurse might feel that an elderly person must have a tablet to put them to sleep doesn't mean that that's going to agree with the person. Because if you give an elderly person, I noticed in their need a sleeping tablet, the next step is they put nappies on them because they don't want them to get out of the bed.
And are you alluding to the convenience of that for the hospital, or are you saying that it is genuinely something that they need and it is to sleep? Are you saying that it's easier to give a sleeping tablet or a nappy?
Well, last year, this time last year, my mother had a fall and I went to the A&E and CH, and I never wanted to have to walk back into the hospital again, but I had to go up. And within 6 hours, my mother had a pad on. And she's still walking in and out of the toilet now at home. They put a pad on her straight away because the nurse said to me they didn't have the staff, so it was easier. So just little things
that's
like
back
that.
Back to creating the proper environment for staff to be able to work in, with the proper staffing levels and the proper backup and the proper facilities.
Oh, I do realise that, Neil, and I know that they need all that, but I mean, at the end of the day, people need dignity. You know, an elderly person needs to have dignity always, up until the end. And like, if a person comes in at 86 or 87 and they're walking to the toilet at home every night on their own,
I understand.
We don't,
I know.
Put
listen,
a pad on them.
I'm very, very compassionate to what you're saying. I spoke to Pauline earlier on this morning, and she gave me a stat that in the A&E there are 137 people waiting. There are four nurses and two doctors, and that's on a good day. So you got four nurses and two doctors trying to cope with the medical needs of 137 people. I mean, that's like an emergency situation, not of the A&E emergency, but of some kind of calamitous event that needs intervention, like an earthquake or a volcano or a bomb explosion or an air crash. 137 people.
It's insane, Neil. It's absolutely insane that that's actually allowed to happen in our hospitals. And, you know, I was even saying to your researcher, when all of those beds are in the A&E, always remember the pressure and the frenzy is on the wards now today in the CUH. Because to get those people beds, they have to get people out of beds in the wards.
And that's why you have bed management going around then to the elderly, trying to move them out, right?
Yes. They're trying to move them out. They're putting pressure on them. And they're telling them, as we were told, my father was removed from the CUH, put into what they called an acute step-down medical care facility back in September 2022. And after 4 days, we had to get him rushed by ambulance back into CUH because he nearly died. With the lack of care that was given, where they sent him, but we as a family were trying to get everything ready at home to bring him back home to die. But because we weren't getting the assistance that we should have been getting, we then ended up having to put my father into a place for 4 days, and he ended back into the CUH in 2022. And I suppose for us, my father ended back in the COVID ward this time because he contracted COVID in the hospital and it went undetected. So he went from the hospital to the home, was never checked for COVID, ended up COVID positive, back in the COVID ward of the CUH, where he subsequently died on Christmas Day. Now, I even said to your researcher, sadly for us, my father also contracted necrotizing fasciitis, which is flesh-eating bacteria, in the hospital.
He got that virus in the hospital?
He caught that virus in the hospital due to excess blood draw from phlebotomists on his hand, where we were told that the wounds were, his hand was so, I suppose, frail, he was so old,
and the infection got in. Now, I suppose the
how do these kind of viruses get into hospitals, though?
But you see, necrotizing fasciitis, we all have bacteria on our skin, Neil. So it's,
all right, okay, we have it anyway. It's just waiting to activate it.
It lives happily on our skin, but if it gets into the body, then it's an opportunistic infection and it'll cause havoc. So I suppose the scariest thing with that was only maybe 1 in 100,000 people get that. But my father didn't present in the hospital with it. He caught it in there and it went unnoticed.
Right.
It wasn't identified soon enough and it wasn't treated quickly enough.
And did your dad, did he have a peaceful passing?
Not really. It was quite traumatic, really, because I suppose at the end of the day, my dad, when he had left, when he was in the home, he got so dehydrated. He suffered something called dehydration encephalopathy, which meant that the dehydration he had caught in the home from COVID being unnoticed and from, I suppose, when he was COVID positive. And I suppose I just want to bring to light here, Neil, this is 2022. My father caught COVID between the hospital and the home, not in the middle of COVID time, but 2022, just over a year ago. And he suffered such dehydration that it affected his brain. So when he came back to us after the 4 days, he didn't, he was having myoclonus fits and he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know who we were. And for the last few weeks, he probably only came back to us once or twice, really. So he didn't realise what was going on. But I suppose as a family, like, these things should be seen in hospitals. They should be treated promptly. They should be identified. And because it's so busy, and I know it's so busy, and it shouldn't be so busy, because we did meet angels of doctors and we met the most beautiful nurses. But we also met awful doctors and nurses who shouldn't be in the profession, no matter what the environment around them is. They weren't suited to that job at all.
Why?
But we met, I just met a few myself because I would have been my father's kind of advocate, where I just thought the manner was appalling. It didn't matter if they were busy, that was no excuse. You're dealing with people at the end of life.
Are you saying rude or abrupt or dismissive or not caring or what?
Dismissive in the sense of kind of, I suppose, you know, because my father was a palliative patient, it was as if, you know, he's dying anyway.
Yeah, I know.
So he got this infection, but he was going to die. But, like, the fact is, if someone... There's an amazing book, actually, Neil. It's by a doctor, Seamus O'Mahony. He is a gastroenterologist. He was a Suhaid gastroenterologist. And it's called The Ministry of Bodies. Now, The Ministry of Bodies is actually a name for the Suhaid because he writes about the hospital, and you should read it. He writes all about the hospital and how, I suppose, the frenziness and the franticness of what's going on in the A&E and what's happening up in the wards. This has gone back a few years. And he wrote another book called The Way We Die Now. And it's about our elderly as well and how they're being treated inside the hospitals. So I suppose, look, all I would say to people is, really, we had a very bad experience. My father did, because, I mean, it was his end-of-life journey, which should be a beautiful journey.
I know, it should.
You know, it should be a beautiful journey, but it wasn't for him. And I suppose at the end of the day, I would just tell people, be vigilant. Be very vigilant when you're going to the hospital.
Okay.
Whether it's yourself, a child, and especially the elderly, please be vigilant with them. Watch the medications they're given and don't let them on their own to be manipulated and kind of pushed into leaving the hospital feeling that it's better to go into these nursing homes.
Okay.
Because what we experienced, I personally would never put a human being into one of those places.
As in, into a geriatric ward of a hospital or into a nursing home?
Into a nursing home, into what they're telling you, that the care is great and you put, when you bring them to the geriatric. Like, all I would say about the geriatric, and as I said, we experienced amazing care in other wards, cardiac care, hepatology, renal area.
Okay,
amazing.
But not in geriatric.
But there's a different atmosphere in the geriatric ward. It's like as if they're there and they're taking up time and they're taking up space. That's just the impression I got. It's kind of like a lot of these older people are palliative care patients dying, but they're not dying fast enough for our system to make room.
Is that a bit unkind, though, to say that, isn't it? That they're going, oh, they're here, like, we don't really have to do much, they're going to die anyway?
Well, that's the attitude I saw. That's what I saw, quite honest. It's not how we felt, because, I mean, to us, my father was coming to the end of his life, and he deserved every dignity and respect. it's like, I mean, a child, like if a baby comes into the world, we have birthing plans and we have everything special for a new baby. But what about a person that has lived for 90 years or 20 years?
Well, that's well put. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm quite sure that we'll get calls and experiences from other people following my conversation with you, Maeve. But thank you so much for taking the call, and I wish you well. I genuinely do. Thank you so much. Text 0868 104 106. Your thoughts, please. We'll pick it up after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Many would say that everyone deserves dignity and respect, especially when being dealt with and also being dealt with in a sensitive medical context when you're in a hospital. But a texter on the list says, I'm sorry now, but can women not handle questions about their physical state while in a hospital? Yes, but I think there's a manner in which the questions can be asked. And I found it strange even myself that I could hear much of the conversations about other people and what they were going through. And I wondered, is there not a better way? On the topic of a lack of privacy in CUH and pretty much every other hospital, it's just not an issue in the emergency department, you know. Even when you're on a ward, there's only a curtain pulled around the bed. You can still hear everything that is being discussed. I'm shocked to hear the amount of people stuck in the CUH. It got me thinking, if this was a private enterprise, it would be closed down on health and safety grounds. This just doesn't happen. It was allowed to happen over many years. I feel sorry for the nurses and the staff. If you were working in circumstances like that, or your family member was, you'd be out of this country and off to some country that has better pay and conditions, wouldn't you? God help us when our government can't even accept the truth. I was listening to Simon Harris and the rest of the government yesterday. If I didn't know better, you would believe we have a brilliant place to live and work. And what a great job the government has done for the Irish people. Knowing what I do know, though, it's the reverse. Over 14 years this has been happening, not today nor yesterday. One other one here, I've been to the hospital. It's like a war zone, constant chaos. No regard for best practice, no regard for hygiene, patient care, and no follow-up on patient issues. People's information is not even being sent back to the GPs. The records of people staying, as in their medical records, are going missing, and there's no follow-up. They have technology systems so that the records could be updated instantly. It's the management who need to be removed. There are too many chiefs, overpaid, and not actually able for the job in the first place. And then somebody else, I read that earlier, you make me sick telling us that you feel sorry for the staff. Well, there you have it nonetheless. Text 0868 104 106. And I'll come back to a lot of texts and emails, but it is important to recap. You may remember the conversation I had on air with Antoinette Burke regarding her lovely and beautiful daughter, Katie, who is now 17, but all of her life she's been living with awful pain, cerebral palsy. She's got a displaced hip, she's got a twisted femur, she's got a twisted pelvis, and she's got a fracture to the pelvis as well. She just wants to be operated on in this country so she can get on with living her life without pain and to live in a happy world. And of course, she was spoken about very lovingly by her mother, Antoinette Burke, on air last week. It prompted us then contacting Pat Buckley, the Sinn Féin TD down East Corkway, and he did promise that he would raise it in the Dáil. He'd already raised it in January with the Minister of State of the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment on behalf of the Minister of Earth Health at the time. See what I mean? It's like all of these people involved. You got ministers of state, you got junior ministers, you got ministers, you got super ministers. God almighty. Anyway, is it understandable why there's so much confusion? But yesterday then, it was yesterday, wasn't it? I believe it was yesterday, he raised it again in the Dáil. Of course, there would have been a lot going on in Dáil Éireann yesterday, but at least Pat Buckley stood up and he yesterday addressed Mary Butler, Minister of State of the Department of Health, who has responsibility for mental health and older people, on behalf of Simon Donnelly. Oh my God.
Here I raise the topical issue of a young lady, 17-year-old Katie Byrne, who's waiting 14 years for a hip operation. Absolute bonkers. And in that topical issue, I said it to the sub-minister at the time that I had approached Deputy Donnelly on the 24th of the 1st this year with that full case file, and as of today I haven't even got as much as a response back. It undermines me and my job. It undermines the credibility of me and my constituency, and that's why I'm raising here today to say that it's not good enough that we're treated like this, but certainly when you're dealing with a young lady that's waiting 14 years for an operation, it simply is not good enough. So I wanted to put on the record that responses from ministers' departments should be more forthcoming so we can do our job. Thank you.
Deputy, thank you very much for your question, and I will follow up on this today. You are aware, I suppose, that we had a situation for the last 6 months that the Forestry Union was not cooperating in relation to giving us responses. 54% of all parliamentary questions that come to the Oireachtas come to health. I cannot tell you the volume that come through us. But in relation to that specific case, and you raised it directly, I will give you a commitment that I will follow up on that today and try and get a response for you.
Okay, so 54% of what she's saying there, Pat Buckley, is what? 54% of all questions that come in from the public are related to health, is it?
Good morning, that's right, Neil.
And she's saying that they can't, that they're drowning in questions and health issues on behalf of constituents. Is that it?
Well, absolutely, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, that'll tell you how bad the system is.
Okay.
I listened to your previous little clip there a while ago, and I think one of your listeners texted in and said management top heavy. It certainly is the issue there, because the frontline workers and staff were amazing.
Okay.
My experience over the years, it's management is a major issue.
So does Simon Donnelly now know, or is he still in the dark? Stephen Donnelly, my apologies.
No, Stephen Donnelly, yes, Minister Donnelly. I actually approached him yesterday in the chamber and I spoke to him and I mentioned that form and Katie's file that I had given to him on the 24th of January. And I said it to him straight out. I said, did you get that file? He said, what file? I didn't get any file. I said, you're joking me. I gave him a very quick synopsis. He was fairly shocked. And he said, will you WhatsApp me on the details? He gave me his number. So at that stage, I just went straight down to my office, photocopied everything, went back into the chamber and put it up in his lap. And I said, there's the whole file.
You see, is that a wise thing to do, to give somebody a big thick file? Because they look at that and they say, oh, God, I can't deal with this right now. Would you be better off with a one-pager?
No. Well, I have a two-pager at the start, which is very simple, Neil. But I mean, I want to give them all the evidence that's there, and all the evidence that I got off Katie's mum and so on and so forth.
Okay.
Because they'll only come back to install you. We haven't got this information, you haven't got that information.
So he has it now?
Nah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because after my chat with Antoinette on the air, I was contacted by Michael McGrath, finance minister, got in touch, and he was very concerned. He wanted to talk to Antoinette and see if he could help. He's a compassionate man, I'm glad to say. And he did get on to Antoinette, and he said that that he was in touch with the CEO of the HSE, and that the CEO of the HSE would actually be talking to Irish surgeons to see if they would do the work for Antoinette's daughter. Are you aware of that?
I am very aware of it, Neil. But what amazes me is we now have to go on a fact-finding mission. Is the information not there already, whether we have or have not got the capability to do specific surgeries?
I know that, but it's not acceptable. Yeah. 14 years of her life. She's only 17. She's been living like this. It's just beyond belief what she's put through as an Irish citizen. But he's saying that the money will be released if the surgeon agrees. He's saying to me that she's top of the list now, and they just need to find a surgeon that's suitable in Ireland.
Well, I hope that that's what happens, Neil. But, I mean, promising something that possibly will never materialise is just the same as what Katie's been gone through for the last 14 years.
I know, but
definitely moving in the right direction.
We're in a much better place than we've been for the last 14 years, or indeed absolutely, Katie and Antoinette. Now you've done what you said you do, in fairness. Antoinette, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not missing anything here. Michael McGrath did talk to you, didn't he?
Michael McGrath did ring me.
He did get on to the boss of the HSC.
He said he was contacting Brenna Gloucester.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call last Friday from a lovely lady in the HSC South. Now, what she said was she has to get all Katie's files from hospitals or service providers, anywhere else that Katie's been. She has to gather all them. So she said, it will take me time to find them. It's about like 14 years of them. It will take her time.
Yeah.
But what she did say was she has to speak to Katie's surgeons here. The surgeons that have told me now for the past 14 years.
Okay. So and you're not optimistic that any one of those surgeons will change their mind then?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
What she said was, if they say that this surgery is not suitable for Katie, they can't help.
So she'd just be left as she is.
So she'd be, like, we'd be left in exactly the same boat as we're in now. You know, I was asked the other day, like, do I have trust in the HSE? No, I don't.
Okay, but did they say anything about if the surgeons...
14 years.
But did they say anything about if no surgeon will do it, that they'll release funds so that she can go to Florida?
No, all she said was if her surgeons say the surgery won't work, they can't help.
And you're inclined to think that that's what the surgeons will say anyway?
Well, I'm not giving up. I don't have much hope in them going against themselves, basically.
Changing their minds,
because if
yeah.
they turn around now and say, oh yeah, it will work. Why, for the past 14 years, have they said no?
That's right. Okay. That is a reasonable assumption to make, it is. And can I ask you, how is Katie? How's her mental health in the last week since we spoke?
She's okay. She's still very quiet. She went back to school Monday. She was out yesterday because she woke and couldn't get out of bed because her hip was at her. So I had to give her painkillers for the pain to kind of dissipate before I could actually do anything to help her. So left her in bed for about an hour after giving her the painkillers, then had to do her physio with her.
Right. Any help at all regarding the suicidal ideation issues from last week? Any better counselling?
She was in CAMHS last Thursday, and they're now looking at putting her on a mild antidepressant or something just to help her cope. So we had to get blood tests done, we had to get a hair trace done and all those type of things for her. So I had to wait for the doctor, obviously. The blood tests are done.
See, if there was a medical intervention, if there was medical intervention and surgery, we wouldn't be having these kind of conversations about mild sedatives and antidepressants and attempting to take her own life and everything. It would be just surgically fixed.
Yeah, like, as Pat was saying there, like, he spoke to Stephen Donnelly yesterday. Stephen Donnelly said he didn't get Katie's files or whatever. So he told her he knew nothing about Katie. So, Pat spoke to Neil Richmond in January, and he said he'd speak to Stephen Donnelly.
Yeah, didn't.
He spoke to Mary Butler in March, which was the audio you played. That
she
was
didn't do anything either. Yeah. Well, she may have done, but she didn't put it in his hand anyway. And it shouldn't be, people aren't delivering and haven't been up to, but people anyway shouldn't have to be looking to collar a minister to fix a problem. But then again, the Irish health system
shouldn't.
Is so bad.
And Michael McGrath, as I said, I'm grateful for his help. Well, he's the Minister for Finance. He's not the Minister for Health.
But he's a local TD taking an interest.
He is a local, I understand
that's
that.
What you want your local TDs doing, regardless of what their portfolio is, taking an interest in the lives of Cork people.
But, like, he could straight away get on to the HSE, try and get something sorted.
Well, he got on to the CEO on the same day.
I'm still waiting to hear from Stephen Donnelly.
Okay.
You know, there's still nothing.
So
nothing from him.
What do you think should happen next, Pat Buckley? Do we just wait now or what?
Well, unfortunately, it has been a 14-year waiting game so far. Morning, Internet.
Morning, Pat.
The Minister has the information, all right? He only had it since yesterday. I'll give him it to the end of this week.
Okay.
And I'd definitely be following up with it again because, as I said, there's a lot of stuff happening in the background here. There are other options and things to look at. But as Antoinette said there, like, if you don't have faith, I cannot see anything changing in the next week. Like, it's fine to say to HSE we're sourcing doctors or surgeons to do this, but I think what Antoinette said is probably the most likely outcome here is we don't have it. We don't have the capabilities or the facilities. And then you have to go and search and see, wait, well, if you don't have it, that's plan A got out the door. What is in plan B? Because we have other options for Katie. And the sickening thing about this is we have the evidence that the operation will work.
In Florida.
Yeah, that's the most frustrating is a very mild word. I could use a lot of profanities this morning on your radio station because That's how frustrating it can be.
Okay, let's give it a week so and see what happens, all right?
Yep. No, I appreciate that.
Is that all right, Antoinette?
Yeah, that's no problem.
Okay. All right, talk to you in a week then, Antoinette. Regards to you and indeed to Katie. Pass on our regards. Very interesting day yesterday, Pat, I suppose. All this new energy that was promised, but no blood in the carpet and everything as you were.
No. I was listening to your show earlier on, one of your speakers were on, and I was saying to myself, it just reminded me of when we were a lot younger, when we were in school, and you swapped the chalk for fizzle sticks. It looked the same, but now it's not working at all. You know what I mean? And that's what actually came into my head. And I said, there's a lot of listeners out there can remember that when we used to change the colour chalk with fizzle sticks. So, no. So I think it's the same old. So, as I said, I think the sooner we have an election here and change the whole lot and change the whole mentality of how the state is run. Because you actually might be, end up idle, Neil, if it's a Sinn Féin government the next time. You'd never know.
It's a Sinn Féin government.
Because, I mean, the issues of housing, the issues of health, the issues of mental health.
Oh, I'd have nothing to talk about. You'll have nothing to talk about. Sinn Féin is some kind of a magic wand that will find something, will fix everything.
Well, the other parties came.
You're going to magic up new hospitals, you're going to magic up 5,000 guards, you're going to magic up 250,000, 300,000 homes. You are in my ear.
There you go. Look, I suppose on a later note, I suppose it's nice for the new Taoiseach on a personal basis, and I did wish him well on a personal basis, you know, and his family. But look, I'm here today in Leinster House, and just the atmosphere here is very, very flat. You know, it just seems to be plodding along.
I suppose that's because there was an awful lot of partying yesterday, I'd imagine, I suppose.
There probably was. I'm due in for another meeting here now in less than 10 minutes. So, but as I said, there's nothing to me personally.
No sense of urgency.
No, absolutely not. Okay. It'll be interesting to see, will it move forward? But from what I'm listening to in the halls of Leinster House here is that, you know, the older staff here and ushers and stuff have seen this all before, so.
Yeah,
Putting the same ingredients into the pot, make the same cake and expect it to taste different. It just doesn't happen.
Thanks, Pat Buckley. Text 0868104106 back after the break.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
The chap who took on an intruder and injured him with a slash hook and then took him off to hospital is covered under Irish law. That is not a prosecutable offence. Texter says to me, he's covered under the Nally law. And that law was used as a defence for the first time in Martin Keenan's trial, allows people to use reasonable force if they find an intruder in their home. It was introduced in the wake of the Padraig Nally case. You might recall it sparked a debate about the rights of home and landowners to defend their properties when the Mayo farmer, Mr. Nally, was actually charged with the murder after he shot dead John Frog Ward, who was a notorious criminal that he found trespassing on his property. So after that, in came the equivalent to the Nally law that covers people in their own homes and what have you. And there, incidentally, with regards to my conversation with Antoinette regarding her daughter Katie, there is a GoFundMe. It's called Help Katie Get Hip Surgery. It's currently just over 20,000. The goal is 300,000, which is the cost of everything involved in her going to Florida to be operated on and surgically fixed by a surgeon in Florida. So it's called Help Katie Get Hip Surgery. I mentioned earlier on this morning as well in other news that 83% of all the vegetables and fruit that we import annually is a disgracefully high figure. The ones that I mentioned were apples and tomatoes and cabbages and carrots and onions and mushrooms and lettuce and garlic and cucumbers and oranges and mandarins and blueberries. There's an interesting point made by Paddy. Why are we importing so much fruit? Go behind Dublin Airport and see the fields and the greenhouses belonging to Keelings, all growing fruit. It's massive. And I suppose amongst them probably would be strawberries. Wouldn't it be quite easy? I imagine, is that in season or all year round? I'd have to go and check again, but I think an awful lot of the time the strawberries that I'm buying are Irish, but a lot of other stuff is not grown here at all. Regarding the importing of most of our fruit and veg, it always makes me laugh when I see how our local supermarkets always promoting how they support local, and yet I regularly take a look in the veg and the fruit aisle and see so many items coming from South America, Africa and parts of far-flung Europe. It puzzles me also when I see cafes and restaurants pushing for the 9% VAT rate to be brought in and some of the customers going online backing them. Yet these same businesses that raise their prices or reduce their portions are the same customers. Are these same customers the ones who are paying out? I don't quite follow what point you're making there. They want the 9% VAT rate brought back because they can't survive with higher VAT rates. Anyway, text, even if the 9% is brought back, will we see these businesses then reduce? Oh, I see. If they got it, would they reduce their prices? Did they ever reduce their prices when they got a reduction in the likes of VAT in the past? I suppose the answer to that is no. But I did mention that we import 25,000 tons of tomatoes every year. It costs us 46 million just for tomatoes. We also import 25,000 tons of cabbages. And you go back years and years ago, there was no importation of all of this stuff. We had farmers growing it ourselves. We import 25,000 tons of carrots at a cost of 12 million annually. 38,500 tons of onions. I mean, they would all fly in Irish climate, wouldn't we? Wouldn't they? The growth of cabbages and carrots and tomatoes. Even things like mushrooms. 11,000 tons of mushrooms imported every year. 7,000 tons of cucumbers. 5,000 tons of garlic. 13,000 tons of lettuce. Although I did hear a conversation the other day, my wife was setting up an order. I think the chap's name is Brian McCarthy. I just think that's his name. My apologies if it's not. But for €25 a week, you can have delivered to your home a big box of in-season vegetables. Plenty of them on a weekly basis. All homegrown, all organically, I believe grown and nurtured and cared for and boxed up in West Cork. So that might make a difference if people could think that that might be a good option. Either way, text 0868104106 and we'll pick it up after 11.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Just as a by-the-by, I'll talk to Deirdre in 1 second there, but I was talking about the huge amount of vegetables and fruit that we import on an annual basis. I was talking about tomatoes and cabbages and carrots and onions and mushrooms and lettuces and cucumbers and loads of different types of fruit, although Keelings do a lot with regards to the fruit department, I get that. We do grow potatoes, like 75 tons are imported every year, but we grow over 300,000 tons of them, so at least we can get that right. But I mentioned then that you can, I'll probably get, maybe I might put in a call to the company that actually do this. They're called CorkRooftopFarm.ie and they do a medium veg box every week. It's €22.50 and they grow all of their own veg. So, and they vary it every week. They've also got the rooftop farm shop down on the Coal Quay every Saturday. I'll have a chat with them on the air, but say a typical weekly box of stuff that you get grown in Cork and delivered to your door would be, I see one week here, it's a bunch of kale, bunch of carrots, lettuce, onions, red onions, white onions, bunch of chard, Savoy cabbage and a bunch of celery. But they also grow spuds and leeks and curly kale and they do sprouting broccoli, cauliflowers, my God, spring onions, peas, beans, white turnips, squash, courgettes, tomatoes, lots of different herbs, pumpkins, radishes, beetroots, loads of stuff. I shouldn't use the word stuff when I'm talking about beautiful, freshly grown veg, but it is there. There are options there. And again, everything needs to be, you know, if it works for you regarding the price, it's a lovely option, isn't it? And you're buying something that's grown locally. Anyway, we'll come back to that in the coming days and talk to the people behind it and give them a bit of a push because it's Cork-like. It's Cork-like. Text 0868104106. Meanwhile, back to our phone lines. Deirdre, thank you so much for holding. Good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
You wanted to pick up, and this started this morning with a live call from the A&E to this radio program. So it's prompted. Yes, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so I sent a text to your line there earlier. Just, I mean, I understand why everything is so crazy at the moment. It's down to the number of hospital beds. I think we're currently at just over 14,500.
There was a time 20 years ago we had a lot more than 14,500.
Well, in 2008 we had 22,500, which equated to a hospital bed for every 196 people. and now we have one bed for 349 people.
If I look at the 20th anniversary of the stats that I have in front of me from Statista.com, mm-hmm. in 2004, we had just under 23,000 hospital beds. The last evidence I have is 2020, 14,500. Can you update the figures from 2020?
It's only increased by about 22 to 32 per year since then.
Okay, so we're going to say...
And actually, there was no increase during the COVID.
Okay, so it's pretty much as you were then.
Yeah.
14,500.
Yeah.
So where did the 7,000 beds go in 20 years?
They were cut after the crash in 2008. The HSE were told to cut their budget. They closed wards. They had a staff embargo. There was no take. They were all agency staff from then. And we're obviously still existing in the same way now.
Yes, but look at the population explosion. There's over 5 million of us now.
It's all regressive, Neil. There is no joined up thinking, no forward thinking, no problem solving ever with anything in the public services that should be made available to the people of Ireland.
So you got a million more people, you have 7,000 less hospital beds.
And more. It's you can't even fathom it out.
Okay. What was your own hospital? What was your own medical experience some time back?
Since the reduction in beds of 2008, and I experienced this firsthand, unfortunately, on the 12th of March in 2011, I became very unwell. I had a severe headache in one area of my head, and throughout the day I kind of deteriorated. By early evening I was at South Dock and they're sending me straight to the CUH. I had private health care insurance, but they said no, you know, there's neurology in the CUH, go there. And after waiting for many hours to be triaged or whatever, I eventually got to sit in a seat and wait to see a doctor in behind the curtains of A&E, and they sent me for a CAT scan. And I mean, I had a little tray in front of me because I was vomiting and the pain, the light, everything. I was really, really unwell, and came back from the CAT scan. And I was completely compos mentis, regardless of what was going on in my head. And I remember the doctor there, probably a junior doctor, said, "The good news is there's no brain tumor, but we're going to admit you and run further tests." So they put me on a trolley on the corridor behind where the check-in desk is in the waiting area of the A&E, A11. And I remained there for 3 days, being treated for migraines. Even though I had health insurance, I wasn't sick enough on their radar to send me for an emergency or MRI. Anyway, in the heel of the hunt, on the Wednesday, now the Fukushima tsunami in Japan had happened. I'm a newsaholic and had been watching this on the TV and everything on the Sunday and the Monday before I ended up in hospital on the Monday evening. And I can honestly say I thought I was in one of those countries where you were in a camp hospital. The business, there was no privacy. These trolleys are quite narrow. You had no side rail, nowhere to go to the toilet. People in and out of offices, back doors swinging, and there was just a sea of beds. And if my memory serves me right, there was about 66 to 67 on trolleys waiting.
Okay,
result was I had a brain hemorrhage and a stroke.
You had a brain hemorrhage and a stroke, but you were being treated because they didn't know that or check for that. You were being treated for a migraine.
No, and at the same time, and now, Neil, I didn't even know I was after having a stroke because I associated with older people. And at that time, they had a campaign on ambulances, fast, face, arms, speech and tongue.
That's right.
Right? Even my children, you know, couldn't believe this after the fact. But anyway, they were quite young at the time. However...
It just reminds me, I need to get somebody on the air about stroke symptoms. Go on, yeah, I must remember that. Yeah.
So anyway, I ended up getting an MRI at about 6 o'clock on the Wednesday evening, and got back from that, and about 20 minutes later this nurse came with a folder and she said, "Now, Deirdre, good news, we have a bed for you, you're going up to 2B now." Going up to 2B from Bay 11 was like being upgraded to a 7-star hotel in Dubai. It was palatial.
Except it was in Dubai.
Well,
I prefer to be on the Wild Atlantic Way or something. I mean, Dubai now to me, if you gave me a 7-star hotel in Dubai, I wouldn't even bother.
Well, I'm just telling you that is what it felt like.
It went I'm only trying to lighten the mood. Go on, yeah.
I know. So anyway, later on that night, I just kind of rested. I was still sick and nurses were in and out and giving me medications. And then the senior house officer came in, doctor, and told me what had happened. It kind of completely went over my head. My partner wasn't with me, and I wasn't really able to absorb the enormity of what had happened. And I ended up spending a month in the hospital because my communication, I wasn't able to talk properly. I had lost the use of the left side and all of that. So,
do you believe that we talk about face, arm, speech, what's the fourth one? Time. Very important. Do you think that things could have been a lot? Your condition might have been improved if it hadn't faster.
Of course, it took me a very long time to recover from that, and thankfully, I like to think perfect again. But it took a long time. But you know, I remember, although my brain didn't function properly for a couple of years and I kept losing words and hitting a blank wall and not being able to remember them or come up with the words to the most basic everyday usage. And I found that very, very debilitating and depressing because...
Were you struggling for words, is it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So, but that's the damage that has happened whilst... You know,
is that because that part of your brain had been damaged by the hemorrhage, by the clot?
That's right. And then it clotted and it caused a stroke.
Right. Okay. What did you do to recover all of your cognitive thinking, your ability to grab words from your brain when you needed them?
Brain retraining myself the whole time. My speech came back fairly quickly, but I just couldn't find words. I still have a slight weakness on my left side, but nothing that would be apparent to anyone else other than I would know that. And then I have nerve damage. So basically from the base of my neck down to my shoulders to my elbows.
I'm sorry to hear that you were left with that disrepair. But what you talk about brain exercises, like what? Crosswords? Yeah. Sudoku books?
Crosswords. Yeah, brushing your teeth with your left hand and everything if you're predominantly right-handed, starting to do things with my left hand.
And that repaired the brain?
It took a good few years, but it certainly helped.
And did you make a full recovery? You don't struggle with words now, or memory. Did you have recall issues, trying to remember things?
No, I've thankfully never had a problem with my memory.
Okay, so you didn't forget people's names or anything, or didn't recognise people?
I might have not remembered their names, but I knew who they were. And I would say, look, you're going to have to give me a trigger here. You know, if it was somebody that wasn't in my close inner circle.
And was that frightening?
Mm-hmm, very much so, and I was 40 when this happened.
40?
So...
You didn't lie down under it, though. You did everything you needed to do to regain.
Yeah. And I had a few, you know, scary reoccurrences that didn't end up being another stroke or bleed or whatever. But it's just something that you have to live with. And if I get a headache, I have a medication that I take. And if that doesn't go away in 30 minutes, you go to the hospital. So I have been back with the same issue twice since then.
And you know your elderly aunt, she had an aneurysm. There's nothing genetic in any of this, is there, do you think?
No, there is no connection there because I'm adopted.
Right.
And she was quite elderly at the time, but I would have been her next of kin. So it was her home health counselor in bed, unresponsive. So she ended up in a cubicle in the A&E, and it was only time. There was quite a lot of damage done. And just to get called the closer family members or whatever, she had never married. So, I remember a lovely doctor who was his first duty in the CUHA, and he was from the north of Ireland, and he wanted to find a side room just to talk to myself and a cousin. And he opened the door and it was just storage box. There was nowhere to talk in private. And it was just another reminding of what happens in our system on a regular basis. Mm. It's not the staff's problem. It's the management. It's the upper management. And now we can see with the small amount of beds that we have in an exploding country.
Yeah.
Of populace, that this is the outcome. And okay. It can't be any different.
Mind yourself. Thank you so much, Deirdre, for taking the
Thank
call.
You.
Much obliged to you. Look you. After yourself.
Bye-bye.
Take care. 2004, just under 23,000 hospital beds. The last actual Statista.com figure is for 2020, but I can't imagine it's changed in any way, shape or form since then. In fact, it's probably got worse. So in 2004, nearly 23,000 hospital beds, pretty much the figure now we're talking about, at best is about 15,000 hospital beds. So somewhere along the track, we lost 12,000 beds. 12,000 beds. Population up by about 1 million.
Call Neil now. 0818-104-106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
One of my favourite artists is Jack L, and I always look forward to any time he's coming in playing Cork, because he always comes in for a visit, and he's going to play us out again this morning. Jack L in studio around about a quarter to midday, thereabouts. But our lines are open. You can text 0868-104-106. Neil, 3 Taoiseachs in 1 term of government. Does that mean that all 3 get a Taoiseach's pension? Yes'm. We never have a general election in Ireland. We have 42 local elections. Another person says, I think Colin Burke would definitely be for the people. He's doing everything in his power to help me with a carer's appeal at the moment, says Connie. Independents are the only way this country will ever work again, Neil. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are gangs that look after themselves and become millionaires. Do you see the problem here? Yeah, rinse and repeat is the problem, isn't it? The new Taoiseach will magic up vast numbers of houses, but none of those houses will ever house any Irish homeless or young families looking for a roof over their heads. Only in Ireland, I suppose. A giveaway budget in October, I think. An election in November. Sinn Féin are on 28%, and at present the government parties 47 combined. More of the same, please, and less of the Greens. We're supposed to be a democratic country, says Shiona. We have a Taoiseach not voted in by the citizens. You'll never vote for a Taoiseach. You never will. Like that. That's not ever going to happen. You'll vote in the TDs and the biggest party then, of course, etc., etc. The country's a mess because of them. There are so many unvetted people in here. Leo always said he was going to retire from politics when he was 50. He said it years ago. Simon Coveney has a job in Europe lined up, I'll bet. Micheál Martin is a disaster. Career politicians is what we have now. The country's unrecognisable. We need a serious visa control department at the airports like Australia has and the USA. I don't want to see Ireland becoming like the UK with little ghettos of nationalities taking over and demanding all sorts of rights, including religious rights, says Shiona. The economy is not booming. The economy is banjacked. That's why Leo bailed before someone points out that the emperor isn't wearing any clothes. It's a booming economy, but there isn't a housing crisis. There isn't a problem with the health service, they say. In a booming economy, there aren't tens of thousands of people homeless, though, are there? In a booming economy, city centres are not overrun with thieves and addicts or a danger of becoming no-go areas. In booming economies, you don't have problems hanging on to law enforcement officers or naval or army personnel. In a booming economy, businesses don't go to the wall in such a way as businesses are doing right now. So no, we don't have, as they say, and Leo said, a booming economy. We were sold a pup by politicians who know the writing's on the wall for them. They're telling us we're flying and we're sadly swallowing it, when in actual fact we're in a nosedive and the ground is coming up rapidly, lads. Government politicians are lining their own pockets so they can ride out the coming storm comfortably. Look around, people. Does it feel like a booming economy to anybody? Says Pat by text to 0868 104 106. So I'll come back to more of those texts and emails, I promise you. Well, there was one other story that happened overnight. I'd like to touch on it, if you will, and I'll come back to everything else, and that is that Cork City Council, now this is more window dressing than anything else, but they did vote last night. There was a vote put forward by the Solidarity People Before Profit Councillor Brian McCarthy. He raised the issue of whether or not Israel should participate in the upcoming Eurovision Song Contest. Now, in the past, a couple of years back, Russia were booted out of the Eurovision. There's an ever-growing amount of people now say one of two things: that Bambi Thug should not perform in Eurovision if Israel performs, or that Israel should be booted out of Eurovision. And they voted on that in council last night, and it was passed. It means that 12 people voted in favour of the motion, 9 against it, with 1 abstention. I always wonder why people abstain from votes as to, you know, what reasoning is there. You don't understand it, or you couldn't care less, or you're kind of torn on it. But anyway, the 12 in favour meant that Cork City Council councillors want Israel to be excluded from the Eurovision Song Contest. So that was Monday night at council. Seamus Whelan was out in the streets actually to ask people of Cork, the people of Cork, if they would support such a move. You know, just get the pulse and the feeling of the people on the streets. Have a listen.
I think they need a lot stronger message than pulling out of the Eurovision, to be honest. I don't think that's going to make much of a stand.
Look what they're doing to the Palestinians.
It's not Israel's fault what's happening. It's whoever's starting to fight the war. It's their fault. I think everyone should be given a chance. It doesn't matter what goes on.
Would we end up saving money by not going?
I say we save a fortune, to be honest. But it'll probably go on something else as well.
Why would we give up on something that we've been doing so well in for a number of years just because someone has...
Well, we haven't in the last few years.
Doesn't matter. We're still putting an act forward, and it's nice to put an act forward, and everybody's supposed to be included in everything.
And young people who are into music, and the Eurovision might be a chance for them to get their name out. My daughter is into music, and she's been on auditions, she's been on these Stars in Your Eyes TV shows and all that. Rounds, I don't see why a young person's dream should be shattered.
But are they complaining about what's happening in Israel?
No, they're complaining what's happening in Palestine.
That's okay. So when we get equal terms of incidents happening in both sides, we can decide then.
Need of politics of the people that's running the country. That's my version on that.
And we should still go to the Eurovision and enjoy ourselves.
Oh, certainly.
But would we not be saving money if we didn't send anyone because we're not doing great for the last
few
years?
You can't take it with you, boy. You can't take it with you.
I suppose there's no pocket in the last suit anyway, Joni.
Nothing in it. As my mother used to say, you can't take it with you. Smile and spend it where you can and give it to your family where you can to see the smile on their face.
Eurovision has been political for years. Look where the votes go. East Europeans vote for East Europeans. The English, because they're all Irish voters, vote for Ireland. Ireland doesn't vote for the UK. It won't actually do anything, but just another little point. Just make another point. What the Israelis are doing in Gaza is wrong.
Okay.
Morally wrong.
Councillor Brian McCarthy, the Socialist, my apologies, the Solidarity Before Profit councillor, raised this issue and this vote at council the other night, and he joins me by phone. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
It's a noble gesture, but even though it's been carried and passed, it doesn't have any clout, really, does it, that vote to boot Israel out?
Well, what's going to happen is the EBU are going to be contacted, and the broadcasters and the performers, with the results, saying the Cork City Council are calling them on them to do this. Now, look, you said there yourself, window dressing, but I mean, this does actually have an impact. I mean, the Eurovision gets a huge audience. There's more than 160 million people watched it last year. And the Israeli state have a long established practice of using cultural events like this to generate good PR on the world stage. And I mean, look, there was a global relations study in the 90s, and public relations today is an essential part of modern warfare. So this is part of a propaganda offensive to back up the military offensive.
You're also backing it up in the sense that in 2022, Russia was banned from Eurovision because of the Ukraine invasion, right?
That's right. They said that allowing them to take part would bring the contest into disrepute. So really, we have to call them out on their double standards here. I mean, are they saying that allowing Israel, which is carrying out a genocide, it slaughtered more than 30,000 people, and they're intentionally using famine as a weapon, are they saying that won't bring the contest into disrepute?
Do we have any idea if anybody else... weren't some of the Scandinavian countries getting very irate about the Israeli participation, weren't they?
Yeah, there's been thousands there's been a lot of organisations and thousands of people, thousands of musicians, for example, who've been signing petitions calling for essentially what my motion called for.
Yeah, but I know some countries were threatening to pull out, but I don't think any have they?
Not as of yet. Okay. And it's not countries, by the way, it's broadcasters are the ones who make that decision.
Okay, there's a distinct difference, but I think you know what I mean. Was there any chance that you would have voted another way in the sense that we would have more power to say to Bambi Thug not to perform?
Yeah, well, we're appealing to performers to make that decision and to put extra pressure on the EBU. Like, for example, if you look at what happened with the music festival in the US, South by Southwest, first one performer announced that they wouldn't do it, and that started up a whole domino effect, and that had a serious impact. So with this, if one performer or broadcaster announced that they were boycotting it because Israel were being allowed to participate, I'm sure that would start off another domino effect. That would put huge pressure on the EBU, and I'm sure as a result of that pressure, it would exclude Israel and not allow them to use this to essentially whitewash what they're doing, which is ethnic cleansing and committing war crimes.
I know what you're saying. They would use it as a propaganda measure to a 160 million audience. But if they were allowed to compete, though, albeit I would imagine the Eurovision is going to come with huge security implications this year more than ever before, would it not make more sense to allow them to compete and then allow the public to, in whatever way, peaceably and law-abiding wise, show their disgust?
Well, I think the Eurovision, the organisers will actually do everything they can to, like, if something like that does happen, they'll do anything they can to censor that. Like, what we're going to see is Israel being welcomed at this international event like nothing's happening, giving this impression of business as usual. Whereas look at what happened when Israel was in Tel Aviv a few years ago, in 2019, I think it was, and when performers, the Icelandic performer Hatari, held up Palestinian flags when the votes were being given out. That was censored from all the broadcasts, and the Icelandic broadcaster was fined €5,000 as a result. So I think that would really kind of shows how the EBU will treat anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, regardless of what's happening in Eurovision and Israel, do you think that Ireland should pull out?
Yes, absolutely. As I said, we'd appeal to for all performers and broadcasters to boycott the event as a result of what's happening. Like, this is a genocide. There is no question.
No, I know that. You're saying that if Israel isn't kicked out, that the others should all boycott Eurovision and it should be cancelled.
That's what we're calling for.
What about all of the artists that have put time and effort and blood, sweat and tears into their performances?
Obviously, they've put a huge amount of effort into this. And this is a huge event. But as I said, what's happening, the scale of what's happening, there's no question business as usual, and I think it would have a huge impact if any of those broadcasters or performers did make that stand.
Okay, do we have a breakdown as to who voted in favour of this motion, which your motion was carried, 12, as opposed to those who voted against, 9, do we know? Was it across party lines?
Not strictly across party lines. I'm afraid I couldn't give you the exact breakdown at the moment, but information will be available from City Hall.
Okay, I might try and find that breakdown. Maybe Terry Shannon, Fianna Fáil, Cork South East councillor, joins me by phone as well. He voted against your motion, incidentally. Terry, good morning.
Neil, good morning. How are you?
Why? I'm good, thanks. Why?
Well, I just think, I mean, City Council of late seems to be, or some councillors seem to think that we're the UN rather than Cork City Council. You know, we've an awful lot of work to do locally, and we spend, I don't know how many, half an hour or more talking about the Eurovision the other night and amendments and counter-amendments. And
did you find that frustrating then? You said there are more serious things to be dealing with in council.
Well, what the motion called for was that we should write to all participants to get them to withdraw. Now, there's hundreds of participants, and Brian McCarthy couldn't tell us who we should be writing to, and you know that's what the council officials wanted. No, but you said all participants, but I suggested that we actually write to the Trade Descriptions Act, people, because the Eurovision isn't Eurovision, and it isn't a song contest anymore. In fairness, it's, I don't know what it is, but I mean, my concern,
it's political. That's what it is, Eurovision. But having said all that, surely it would at least show or disgust with what's happening in Gaza, Gaza Strip, Palestine.
I think, there are marches every week all over the country and all over the world. I mean, we have a Cork participant, and we should be getting behind the Cork participants, Bambi Tug. And my concern is not necessarily or just with the Eurovision. It's about politics involving themselves in sports.
Oh, that's
in culture,
interesting.
In
okay,
art,
you think that I understand. So develop that point. You see that politics and entertainment and arts.
Yeah, I mean, just because somebody has a political point of view, we're now saying that maybe someone who's training for the Olympics, years and years and years of training, hard work, tears and toil, and because someone has a political point of view, they're being told, sorry, you can't participate, and that's the end of their career.
And I try to make that point to you, Brian, not as well as Terry Shannon, but it's career-ending for many people who are looking for a good performance at Eurovision and aren't involved in politics.
Just because someone has a point of view. And like, politicians are entitled to have their point of view, but there is a political arena, and then there should be cultural arenas and artists' arenas and song contests, and politicians should stay out and they have their own fora for making statements and making points of view in politics.
I'd dispute that it'd be career ending. I mean, Bambi Thug, for example, has already had a successful musical career. And several of the other performers have, and this is just another part of their career. But
this could be very different. You're talking about a potential ABBA, a potential Bucks Fizz, a potential Cliff Richard. You know,
let
Brian respond. Limited with time, so go ahead, Brian.
If any of them did take that stand, I think it would actually reflect very well on them. Several of them, including Bambi Thug, have already said that they're against the genocide. They've come out calling for a ceasefire. Now, if they took this step and people were willing to see that they were willing to take such a massive step to put their principles on the line to show solidarity with Gaza, to oppose the genocide, I think that would actually reflect very well on them.
Okay, but the European Broadcasting Union would make the call, and they haven't banned Israel, so they're not likely to any time between now and May.
Well, I think if some of the performers and broadcasters started to pull out, they absolutely would. No performers, no Eurovision. It would be the most effective way to put them under pressure.
Okay.
Well, you see, Neil, I suppose for me, the question arises, where would this end? I mean, there's nobody blind to what's happening in Palestine. Certainly I'm not, and nor do I support what's happening, what Netanyahu are doing. But I mean, you know, there's conflicts all over the world. There's different political ideology all over the world. And what this what we're saying is, just because a politician has a political point of view, or a particular point of view, that other people who are not involved in politics should suffer.
People did intervene that weren't involved in politics. I mean, this is perhaps for another day, but the Dunn Stores girls, the strikers who refused to handle South African produce, went international.
And that's fine, but they
in 1936,
they were,
We boycotted the Olympics in Berlin because we were being told what we were was not really, you know, a free state and such, and we were going through the throes of trying to get a 32-county Ireland. So we have history of this, you know?
We do, but even with the Dunn Stores, they weren't asking people to make life-changing
decisions. They were asking people to boycott anything, you know, that came out of apartheid South Africa, so...
Oh, they were, but they weren't saying to someone who had spent a lifetime of training, of dedication, of commitment to their art, you know, and there are people who train. For instance, would we be saying no for the Olympics? What about soccer? What about all other sports? And my concern really is, where would it end? And are we now going to say that politicians are going to decide who goes to what and when and where?
Okay.
I think that's bad.
Well, go ahead. Last word to you, Brian.
Terry, are you saying Russia should be allowed back into the Eurovision?
I'm saying that we should have a separate arena for politics There's the UN, there's council chambers.
Answer his question. If you're to follow your narrative and your logic,
I think there should be a separation of politics and culture and art and sport and song contest, because I think it is life changing for people.
It's a question that needs answered. Do you agree that Russia should be left in or kept banned from Olympics?
I don't particularly support, obviously, what they're doing either. But I think there are different arenas for people to make their point. Okay. Right. So, you know, I that's the point, because the concern I have is that as politics evolves and we see how
don't
it is evolving,
don't mix
all of a sudden,
right.
You know, who's going to decide? And are politicians now?
Okay, much obliged to you both. Thank you so much. Don't involve the two. I understand that. I'm going to finish up this morning. Thank you so much, Councillor Brian McCarthy, Councillor Terry Shannon. I'm going to let music do the talking itself after the break.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation, the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. Being part of the conversation, or at least the programme this morning, the great Jack Lukeman. Jack L is in studio because he plays the Opera House on May the 4th, and I'll tell you more about tickets in a couple of minutes' time, but let's get the music to do the talking. So, Jack L, in your own time, my man, welcome to Cork.
Hello, everybody. This is Battle of the Hawthorn Trees. Me mother, for you know I sinned. I spent all my money on these brittle things. Bless the kingdom that we've built on sand, all the world right there in your hand. Bless the blackbird in the hawthorn tree, she waits for the blooming of the red berry. The battle of the hawthorn will never be won. You're as beautiful in winter as you are in sun. Oh, the battle of the hawthorn trees. Shivering fields with your fresh breast thistle and St. Bridget's cross, the lily white sky, pillow of moss. My love, she gave to me the jewels of a mind, and I hung them on the branches, frozen in time. Survival when we're all one blood. Bless the blackbird in the hawthorn tree, she waits for the blooming of her destiny. The battle of the hawthorn will never be won. Black skeleton in winter, white wing in sun. My love, she gave to me the jewels of her mind, and I hope branches frozen in time. Whoa, the battle of the hawthorn trees. Whoa, the battle of the joke of me. That's mesmerizing.
Oh, thanks.
That's scary stuff. Every time I hear that is the most. You have the most distinct, bass heavy, beautiful, smooth voice. You mind it?
Well, yeah, as much as possible. I mean, singing itself for a couple hours every night isn't good for your voice.
Isn't ideal.
And this hour of the morning, it's Darth Vader sings the blues.
Oh, man, your talent is just on a different level entirely. Oh, no wonder your popularity is just soaring. The Opera House, full band, I hope?
Full band in the Opera House, yeah. A couple of great musicians. They actually have their own music and stuff. Jerry Eaton and Duncan Maitland, Louis Boland, Mark O'Bell. So, yeah, and... Rebecca Mack supporting, and we've got we've been working on some really cool visuals. We've got the old AI working for us.
Go away!
Yeah, so we've got some really cool stuff that we're working on for the show.
That's the world we live in now, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's anything that enhances. Obviously, you have AI. To watch yourself with this stuff, but if it can enhance things, and I mean, it's.
You could get Hendrix to walk out, or you could get something. Gallagher could walk out. Could come out.
I mean, it's all going to get very weird because you're going to get movies now with Marilyn Monroe and James Dean starring in a Western.
Scary, you know,
you can have yourself in the movie. You know, it's just going to get so surreal. It really is. We don't realize what's going to happen.
The pace at which things are moving at. So you're flying. I mean, you're obviously touring a lot, but you've done DeBarra's, you've done the Opera House in the past, you've done the Everyman, you've done Sea Church. Great venues.
Oh, I love it.
Thanks be to God we have them.
Yeah, and I've been lucky to play, you know, them over the years and see them develop, even the Cork Opera House go from the way it was to being, you know, what it is now. It really works. It's a beautiful venue. I mean, I played it when I used to have the orchestra pit, and I remember one time, I used to, you know, back in the day when I used to jump over the orchestra pit into the audience. And I only did it once.
Think you are in the Sex Pistols?
No, I did it once, and I got stuck in the audience and couldn't get back to the stage.
You think you're Bono at Live Aid?
Yeah, the very same thing. You get stuck in the hallway of the place.
Behave yourself. You should have more sense.
Yeah, you get carried away. You know, it's all about getting carried away.
Just a quick question. I didn't want to spring this on you. You just pass if you want. Music and politics, should they mix?
Oh, well, they always have and they always will, I suppose. As regards asking somebody who, I mean, people have to remember that the music business survives despite itself. It's only a new thing. You know, we were the paupers walking the roads singing songs years ago, and we're not. I'm lucky I have an audience, but people who are only starting out or don't have an audience, it's very, very hard. And you know, saying to people boycott this is like asking somebody to give up their job. I think maybe Israel should be, you know, boycotted from anybody partaking in any war. It's disgusting in this day and age. It shouldn't be happening. We're smart enough. We have the technology. We have the means to solve all this crap. So, you know, I'm not into any kind of warmongering or anything like that. But I think people have to understand that musicians are down.
Okay.
Unless you're Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran, you won the lotto.
It's a tough graft.
It's a tough graft, yeah, and very hard. It. And it's getting harder.
Respect the artists, respect the acts. Okay. Well, listen, thanks for answering that. I do appreciate it. I'm going to give away some tickets for the gig at the Opera House. It's May 4th, guys. The €30 ticket. They're available at the box office. They're also available on Jack Lukeman's excellent website, jacklukeman.com. If I rush, I can get a second song out of you. I know I'm greedy as hell. Any chance of that?
Absolutely, yeah. I'll do this one. It's from, I did a lockdown album. This was from the 80s night that I used to do live streams. And here's this one. People may know this one. Somewhere in the city where the air is still, a baby being born to the overkill. Who cares what people say? Walk down love's motorway. Ambition and love, wearing boxing gloves and singing hearts and flowers. And somewhere in my heart there is a star that shines for you. Silver splits the blue. Love will see you through. And somewhere in my heart there is the will to set you free. All you've got to be is true. Star of
of the city in the northern chill. A baby being born to the overkill. No say, no place to go. A TV and a radio. Ambition and love, wearing boxing gloves and singing hearts and flowers. And somewhere in my heart there is a star that shines for you. Silver splits the blue. Love will see you through. And somewhere in my heart there is the will to set you free. All you've got to be is true. Somewhere in my heart there is a star that shines for you. Silver splits the blue. Love will see you through.
That's magnificent. It really and truly is.
Thank you.
Great, Jack L. Thank you for calling in, my man.
Thanks
great
for
to
having
see you.
Me. Thank you so much.
Stay healthy, fit and happy. Jack L. plays the Opera House on May 4th. You can book tickets directly at the Opera House box office, Opera House, corkoperahouse.ie. I have three sets of tickets to give away right now for callers 9, 10 and 11. You and whomever you choose to take with you, see the great Jack L. and the band at the Opera House. Get on the phone now, 0818 104 106. The great Jack L. in studio. Thank you. We did a Twitter poll overnight. We got a response of about 580 different people responded to my Twitter poll this morning. Do you have confidence in Simon Harris to run the country? We ran it for 12 hours. 77% of those who responded said no, they don't have confidence. 23% says yes. I'll leave it at that. You can judge that for yourselves. Have a good day. I'll see you tomorrow.
When Cork talks,
Cork people blow my mind.
They talk to Neil Prendeville
on Red FM.